way that we have come to understand neighbor, rhetorically, has implications for the way that we live ethically.
Welcome to the At Sea Podcast. I'm your host, Justin McRoberts. In her landmark book, Caring for Words in a Culture of Lies, Marilyn McIntyre writes, "If language is to retain its power to nourish and sustain our common life, we have to care for it. In something like the way good farmers care for the life of the soil, knowing nothing worth eating can be grown in soil that has been used up, fertilized, or exposed to too many toxic chemicals." Well, there might not be a cultural sphere in greater need of that kind of word care than that of American Christianity. My guest on this episode of the At Sea Podcast is author, journalist, and cultural critic, Jonathan Merritt. His most recent book is entitled Learning to Speak God from Scratch, and is, in my reading of it, a courageous and wise effort in the direction of caring for words that shape our contemporary religious life. In my conversation with him, we dig into that book, its history, and a few other pieces of the soil beneath our feet. Check it out. You are in Brooklyn right now. This is where you are. And you chose to move to Brooklyn. How long ago did you move to Brooklyn?
I moved here 5 years ago.
Now, was that like a specific, like it was Brooklyn specifically? Was that in your brain? Or was it like, I need to move to a bigger place? Were you just trying to get out of the South? Like, what was the move actually about?
I came up here and was feeling for a long time, I was living in the suburbs of Atlanta, and I felt like this stirring that it was time to go somewhere else. I've never been a suburban kind of person, but that's where I was living. I had bought a house. I felt really chained to that place. And I was up in New York, and I remembered being 12 years old and coming up here for the first time and saying, I'm going to move here one day. And I thought, maybe this is something I should do. And so I talked to a friend, and I said, why did you move here? She had moved up here with her husband from Atlanta, 3 kids, one of whom is special needs. And she said, you know, sometimes in life there comes a whisper, and it's a totally legitimate life decision to say no to the whisper. But if you do, it will go away and it will never come back again.
Wow.
And I thought about all my friends who today, they don't have the whisper, but they have a memory of the whisper. So they'll say something to you like, I always wish I would have finished college, had children, got married, gone to the mission field, moved to New York. And I thought, you know, it's not a current tug. They don't want to do it now. They just remember when they did.
Yeah.
And I thought, I don't want that to be me. So I was flying home. That was in the middle of September. And by the time I hit the ground, I said, I need to go now. And I packed up my house. And I was here by November the 3rd. I moved into an apartment I'd never seen with roommates I'd never met in a neighborhood I'd never even heard of.
See, I love, and you, the whole notion of like being able to miss a moment, I'll be honest with you, I don't feel like that gets enough airtime in the way we talk about like destiny and plans and like the future. And it's like, you can absolutely miss a moment. And when you do, you don't get it back. Like oftentimes you might get a different one, but like if a moment goes, it's usually gone. And there's that, that story in Acts about Philip who hears from the Spirit of the Lord and says, go south. And it's only after he goes south does he hear the next instruction, which is go to that chariot and stay near it. And part of what I recognize in that story is like, how many folks have heard go south, that whisper, and then never acted on it? And then never heard the next instruction and have been wondering for months, if not years, like, why don't I ever hear anything anymore? Like, why don't I feel inspired? It's like, well, because you didn't act on it when you heard it the first time. So you moved. You moved because it was like you had an inkling and you chased it. Did you know kind of what you were after when you moved, or did you have specifics, or was it literally just, I'm going to go and we'll see what happens on the other side of this?
You know, there were a lot of things. There's the professional side, which I've talked about some in years past, which is I'm a faith and culture writer, and New York represents in many ways kind of the leading edge of culture. It's kind of upstream of the rest of America, in some ways the rest of the world. So if you look at New York, you're almost looking into your future if you live in middle America or even in the deep South, even in a city like Atlanta, where I was. Like, you know, you're kind of like, you go through a time machine to get here. You're going into the future in some ways. And so it's really allowed me to tap into conversations that are happening that I wouldn't have had access to before. But there's also a personal reason. Like, I felt in the South, you know, I was a teaching pastor at my dad's church. My dad's a very prominent religious figure, a very strong personality. My family is very strong, tight-knit family. And I'm so different. In some ways, you know, I'm that quintessential black sheep middle child. And I thought, I'll never be the person, I'll never be fully Jonathan unless I create some geographical distance. As much as I love them, and I've never said this to them exactly like this, hopefully they won't listen to this, or this will be an interesting Christmas. But I just felt like, you know, you as a person, I knew, you know, once I became 30, I was like, I need to individuate. I need to be my own man and stand in my own shoes and in my own space. And so this was really critical for me to do that as well.
And geography was... it was the thing you could control. Is that sort of the, is that sort of how that works? Like, you could, because where you live, like your actual environment, your place. I mean, Wendell Berry talks a lot about place and the understanding of place and how place shapes a soul. Geography, it was the thing you could control about that. Like, you can want to redesign your life and sort of revamp your identity or dig into who you actually are, but your environment can actually disallow that. That's sort of what you're getting after.
Yes. Yes. And I think that, yes. So I've always believed, you know, and you talk about this sense of place. I've always had a theology of place or an awareness of place. And part of that's because I'm a writer. So you begin to realize, like, if you're in a place of chaos, there are whole, like, creative impulses in you that get, like, tamped down and suffocated. And so you start to kind of realize how you respond to place, and that place matters. And in the suburbs, there was a real lack of local culture. You know, you could almost like close your eyes, go to sleep, and somebody carries you to the next suburb in the next city, and you open your eyes and you're just like in the same place. So there was a real lack of that. There was a real lack of artistic creativity in the suburbs. So for me, I think there are some people who you know, it works for the things that they want in life. It was also a very unsustainable kind of existence. I'm very environmentally thoughtful. And, you know, I was living in a gigantic house and driving 20 minutes to go anywhere. And here, you know, I don't have a car. I walk everywhere. I live in a shoebox. And so I also find the sense of community in this place is really special. And even
more special in when you say special, you're differentiating between your experience of community before and your time and you're tying that to your geography. In what way is it special in Brooklyn for you?
So when I lived in Atlanta, it was how would I say this? Like, you know, I'd pull into my suburban neighborhood and you pull into your driveway and you close the garage door, and then you're just sort of live in this fortress. Right. And I didn't really know my neighbors. I didn't interact with them, like everybody, because we our favorite coffee shop is in one part of town, and our favorite and our work is in one part of town, and everything's kind of dispersed. You really see your house as just a place to live. It's the place where you live. It's not necessarily the place where you meet your friends. Your friends come from all over. In New York, everything gets squished together. So the neighborhood where I have my friends and where I have my coffee shop and barista and where I walk and my park and my work and my all of my things are kind of squished together because, you know, New York's sort of divided up by neighborhoods. And so as a result, you're connecting with people in various spaces. You know, I run into the guy, the bartender at my favorite wine bar at Whole Foods. And it's not like it used to be. I have had more interaction with the people who live in my building. I'm closer friends with the people who live in my building than I ever was with anybody that lived in my neighborhood.
Because you're because of the actual, like the actual physical proximity, you are physically, geographically closer to people, and that actually forces a choice. You still have to make the choice, but it actually forces the choice more regularly to act on that and actually engage and be in more regular community.
Yeah, and you're stacked on top of each other, and it might take you 30 minutes by train to get over to where your coworker's neighborhood is, right? Like if I have a friend in the Upper West Side, it could take me 45 minutes. My friend Jana, I love her to death. I see her like 3 times a year because nobody travels that kind of distance on the regular to see people. You really do kind of self-segregate by neighborhood. And when it snows and nobody goes to work, here we are all we're all stuck. We all have the same restaurants. We live life together. And so that's been very important for me, I'd say.
Yeah. Part of what you're describing a little bit, I mean, you're playing around a little bit with the idea of home, like what it means to be home. Because, I mean, you still, like, if someone asked you, like, where home is to you, I'm assuming a couple of things. One, I'm assuming that means something different now than it did when you left Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
It does,
and two,
yes.
Do you still consider Atlanta home, and how's that changed?
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the best essays on home is a chapter from Diana Butler Bass's book Grounded, and in it she has a quote, and I cannot remember. I'm so sorry, Diana, if you're listening to this. I can't remember who it's attributed to, so I'm just going to attribute it to her. But she says, home is where you are understood.
Ooh.
And in some ways, do I feel understood in Atlanta? Yeah, I do. In ways that I'll never be understood here, because I have people there who've walked with me for more than 3 decades, who've known me when I have pooped my pants as a 3-year-old, or, you know, like they know me, they know right. The awkwardness of my adolescence, which no one here can ever know. And yet, there are whole expressions of me that really, in a place like that, in the kind of conservative South, where, you know, I think of that phrase in the Bible, like a prophet is not honored in his own hometown, which right. actually gets at something really basic, that people who knew you when have a hard time knowing you now, because they always see the now through the lens of the when. And so it's like, you know, I walk into a space and I don't come in with a clean slate. It's yeah. like, oh yeah, this is the person who knew me when I was 16 and I was like, you know, getting like a minor in possession of alcohol and embarrassing myself and partying too much and all these things. And so you can't just reset. So I always think of my life, and I think of Atlanta and New York this way, kind of like the rings of a tree. Is Atlanta my home? Yes, it is. And is New York in my home? Yes, it is. There's who I was and who I am. And in many ways, those things are connected and they're the same thing.
That's really good. I was speaking with a friend the other night who talked about the difference between, he said, what we end up, what we long for is a sense of home, but what we settle for is a sense of comfort, and that comfort ends up keeping us from the kind of discomforts that form identity. And that part of what you're talking about, like being on top of one another, being sort of like sandwiched in and having to run into people, there's a kind of discomfort there where suddenly, like, you're actually drawn out of yourself. But in actually practicing that, you actually create a sense of home and belonging, because you have to choose it. You have to actually be part of that formation. You don't just like find it, because I think that is the thing, right? It's like the idea of home. Somehow you just step into a place and there's a mold and you just set yourself down into it. But really you end up helping to form the place and have and for yourself, which it was a choice you made moving to Brooklyn. And part of what came with that formation was, part of your discomfort was language, which is the sort of impetus for, or I think this is true, the impetus for learning to speak God from scratch. Was part of your discomfort in Brooklyn was, oh snap, like my religious language doesn't click here, and my religious language is actually a significant part of how I talk about life. Can you talk about that, like,
yeah,
the arrival, you know, the arrival in Brooklyn and coming into conflict there?
Yeah. So you're getting at something, and it's not something I've ever really talked about in public before, because I've never, you know, really put together my ideas, which is that New York has a way of stripping people bare. I think it's why generations of Americans, and indeed generations of global citizens, have come to New York for hundreds of years, really, or more than 100 years, certainly, to find themselves, and they've done so successfully. Why? It is in part because of the size, because of the scale, because of the discomfort that you experience here, where you almost cannot be any size fish in a pond this big. So, you know, I think of Henry Nouwen thinking, when he said, you know, that the three primary lies we tell ourselves is, I am what I do, I am what I have, and I am what other people say about me. And the thing is in New York, all three of those lies are obliterated the day you move in. Because to be, you know, in the South, if I said, I'm a writer, people are like, oh my gosh, a writer? I don't know a writer. Have you ever written anything I would know? And I could just live into that identity. In New York, you know, everybody you meet does something cool. Yeah. It's the only place they never ask a follow-up question when I say what I do. I mean, it's like, you meet somebody, you're like, I'm a writer. And they're like, cool, I'm an accountant. Moving on. Like, what do you think about? And then I am what I have. You know, I moved here and everybody in New York is rich and everybody in New York is poor. Like, it takes a lot of money to live here, but you spend it all living here. And so it's so hard and so difficult to just to survive here and pay the bills that nobody really has a lot of margin financially. And so you can't just kind of throw your money around or be the guy who's doing very well here. You're just kind of, everybody just sort of coexists together and nobody's, you know, even the richest among us live in a house probably like a third of the size of the rest of America. It's not like you're like, you know, there's no Rolls Royce because you don't own a car. Yes. Like, it's just totally different. And I am what other people say about me. People here don't care.
Yeah.
Nobody here is talking about me. And when I go to dinner and I say, oh my God, it was the worst day. These people at the Gospel Coalition were bad-mouthing me. People are like, what the heck is that? Like, why are we even talking about this?
Who are they and why do they matter?
Yeah. So now, as Nouwen says, when those three lies are stripped away, you begin to really ask, who am I really? Mm. Who's Jonathan Merritt really? When you don't have your job and your possessions and even your reputation to sort of become a stand-in, to become a surrogate for your true identity, who are you really? Mm-hmm. And Nouwen says that the journey then is to get where you can honestly say as your first stop, I'm God's beloved. And so to wake up every morning and say, I am not Jonathan Merritt, the writer. I am not Jonathan Merritt, the person who makes X number of dollars a year or the person who had this many retweets. I am God's beloved and God loves me today. And there's nothing I can do to make God love me one whit less or one whit more. It sounds easy and it's the most difficult journey of my life.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, one of the struggles that I encountered here was, as you mentioned, and this was the impetus for learning to speak God from scratch, is this language barrier. Yeah. Like I could speak English, but I really struggled to have spiritual conversations. And it's not because New York is some kind of secular, anti-Christian. It's not at all. It's not. That's a myth. That's not true. We're quite spiritual. People are open to having spiritual conversations. But when I encountered those spaces, when I entered into those spaces, what I began to realize was many people were not familiar with the words I was using.
Right.
And I was not always sure I understood what they meant when it got right down to it.
Yeah. Well, even to your previous story, which for me is powerful insofar as, you know, you're talking about even the phrase, you know, God's beloved, like you can say a thing like that about yourself, but like, it doesn't mean shit until it actually has to. Like, it's just a thing until, like, you're describing this situation, which you get to cling on to your job. You get to cling on to other people's words. You get to cling on to the things you have until you don't have those things. And then suddenly being God's beloved, that either has to actually mean something or you have to question the truth of the thing at all.
Yeah.
Like reevaluating that, like you had to come to a place where your own words had to mean what they actually mean, or you had to like dig in and find their own meaning. Even God's beloved had to mean something because you didn't have those other three things to cling on to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it does drive you down. It strips off all of the veneer of the things you thought you knew. You know, like if you're listening to this and you grew up in a religious culture, it's like you know exactly what you're talking about when you talk about God until you don't.
Yep. Right.
Until that moment when somebody goes, "Oh yeah, what does grace mean?"
Mm-hmm.
My wife was killed in a car accident while she was pregnant. Tell me what grace means. What does it mean? Because what does that mean for me? Mm-hmm. And you go, yeah, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, all the little index cards with those definitions that you memorized in Sunday school and all of the flannelgrams and all of the Christian BS that you relied on that was empty and trite and hollow and disembodied suddenly doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
And I find that people, you don't have to move to New York to experience this because the world is changing all over the place.
New York's kind of coming to you.
Yeah, exactly. Because thanks to the internet, you know, we're all engaging with people all the time.
Right.
And we're engaging with people who differ from us in race and religion and socioeconomic status and cultural mores and gender identity and sexual orientation. And when we're in spaces like that and we're undressed rhetorically, mm-hmm. we start to realize, yeah, I don't actually know what I'm saying when I'm saying what I'm saying.
Right.
Well, when that happens, we just stop talking about it altogether. Yeah. And here I was, a faith and culture writer in New York City, thinking I was going to conquer the iron wilderness with my faith, and realize I was totally helpless. I could no longer speak God.
Yeah. So one of the things you do with the book, it ends up being sort of, I don't know if it's necessarily the heart of the book, but certainly it's like the sort of the functional apex of the book, is you actually do a thing that I do here with this podcast. It's kind of this practice of lexicon where you take a word and break down not its like intrinsic meaning, but like its functional meaning. And I think you actually write about this in, yeah, from the book. You're like, the dictionary isn't necessarily like a place where you find like the rooted, intrinsic, eternally grounded meaning of a word. What you find is, this is how this word works in function, which then it's actually a bit flexible then, because from person to person, age to age, culture to culture, uh-huh. a word like neighbor, as an example, which you get to in the book, that means something different. And so uh-huh. we do this at the podcast here, is like, I'll usually like make a segment out of like tossing words at folks. Like, here's a word that means something in or around your world, your vocation, your culture, you know, talk about it. It's what you do with the book. So what I'd love to do is instead of just read sections, I'm going to set some of these in front of you and ask you to vamp a little bit on some of the words that you'll already be practicing vamping on from the book.
Thank you. Thank you, by the way, for choosing from the book, because if listeners don't know, the last half of the book is like 19 essays on 19 different words, and it kind of puts into practice what I'm saying. But it's so funny when I get on like podcast or whatever, I talk to people on the radio, and it becomes like spiritual Houdini, where they're like, let me throw a word at you. And it's like, I haven't studied that word. What about this word? Reimagine this word in real time. And it's like, I don't know. I haven't done any work.
Well,
what
that does is it actually kind of betrays the actual, like, which is, again, so important to what you're doing in the book. It actually betrays the actual function of language in a human life. You can hit me with a word that I don't use, I haven't thought about, and I can just talk about it. But if it hasn't like dwelt in my soul, if it's not something I'm using functionally, if it's not something that like, if it's not a tool I'm using regularly, I don't really actually know it. I can tell you what the definition is, but what, in terms of meaning, that's relational, that's cultural, that's functional. So I'd love to start here. The word you mentioned before, and it's a word you break down here, and it's a word that gets tossed around all the time, which is part of what you do with the back half of the book, these words that get used. The word grace. So this is the way I would normally do it. I'm just going to say the word, and I'm going to put it on the table in front of you, and you take it for 45 seconds to a minute and a half, or however long. Like, tell me about the word grace.
Yeah. So the word grace is one of those things that I actually, you know, I ended up, there's a story in the book about getting caught in the rain and giving away umbrella after umbrella until I was totally soaked. And what I realized in that is that that there is in some ways a, I would say, we have only explored the word grace in terms of what it means to be a receiver of grace. And it typically is something we talk about God's grace. So in religious communities, when you say grace, what is grace? Somebody will say, okay, that is when God fill in the blank, and it's always from God to you, and right. that's a kind of grace. And yet, what does it look like to be a giver of grace? Hmm. What does it look like not to be a container of grace, but a conduit of grace? And actually, that's the pits. That flowery understanding of grace that works real well in a Hallmark card is great when God is giving you something you don't deserve. Mm. But so many of us, when we become conduits of that and we give others the gift that they didn't deserve, they maybe didn't even ask for, it hurts, it's hard, there's a breaking that comes with it. And so all of a sudden, when it feels like it feels, we don't call that grace, because grace has always had a positive feel to it. And actually, grace in reverse is actually really difficult. It's a hard thing. You have to wrestle with it. You have to struggle with it. You have to kind of unclench your fists around it in order to give it away. And that's something now that I'm always thinking about when I go, oh man, this was just the grace of God. Now I go, okay, now if I take that as a container, that's one thing. But now if I channel that out into the world, that same thing that I received, if I gave it away, if I put it out into the world and in other people's spaces, what would that look like? And I go, I don't want that so much. I think I'll just sit here and keep receiving whatever it is I think that I'm receiving from God.
Talk about the word neighbor. It's something that comes up on this podcast and conversation quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And you vamp quite a bit on the word neighbor. I'd love you to do two things here. One, just vamp on the word neighbor, and then talk about the way neighbor, and we talked about it a little bit, has changed. What's the difference between being a neighbor for you? How is Jonathan Merritt a different neighbor functionally in Brooklyn than he was or is in Atlanta?
Yeah, I think neighbor has, if you think about it in kind of comprehensive terms, it has kind of two parallel meanings. One is neighbor, the guy who lives in my building, the guy who lives across the street from me. Right. And I have an obligation to them because our lives the stories that we have lived have now intersected. Mm. And now I have an obligation to that person. So that's hard, because when I know that it's an inconvenience, but somebody else might need something or benefit from something, I have to proactively, not waiting for somebody to ask, go and serve and help and do. That's really hard.
Yeah.
Most of us, if I asked you, when was the last time you served your neighbor? You did something. You said, hey, you know, I was cutting my grass. I saw your grass need cutting. I cut your grass. When's the last time you did a check-in? When's the last time you just shared space with them and gave them a chance to kind of rub off on you emotionally, to kind of share whatever it is they're struggling. Most people don't do that on the regular with people who live near them. I gave the example in the suburbs of my house. Now, some of us do. If we get that far to caring proactively for the people whose stories have intersected our own, the people who are neighbors geographically, that's about the best most of us do in terms of neighbor love.
Yeah.
But when you think about neighbor, not just in terms of being linked by proximity, but being linked by humanity, mm-hmm. if you think about that your neighbor not being someone who is defined by nearness, but by neediness, all of a sudden it becomes unbelievably overwhelming to a lot of people. Who will you help today? Who will you help? Because there are people all around the world in need. There are people all around the world whose humanity, whose dignity is being threatened. And what are you doing? What's your obligation for those people? I mean, you know, we had a debate in this country about refugees.
Right.
And people were saying, you know what, we've got enough problems in our own country. We need to care for the kids in our own country. We've had a debate in this country about immigrants and the children of immigrants. If the government came into your neighborhood, your physical neighborhood, and was separating mothers from children, you would be alarmed. You would do everything in your power to intervene because that person is your neighbor.
Right.
And yet, particularly in the Christian tradition, the person being held in a detention center on the border of Mexico, that person is my neighbor. We are linked not by proximity, but by our humanity. Mm. And I have an obligation to them. But because we have narrowed our understanding of neighbor to just being the guy across the street, the guy who I share space with geographically, we then attenuate our commitments to people who actually need our help. And it impacts our public policy. It impacts our philanthropy.
Yeah.
It impacts our compassion. And so I think we have to begin rediscovering the word neighbor in a wider, roomier, more comprehensive sense. And I think the world actually needs that from us.
Yeah, I love this line from the book. You said, some in our culture believe that we become stronger by being more inwardly focused or inward focused, that building walls and closing borders is better than the biblical mandate to invite all to the table. And then this, when it comes to neighborliness, we are connected by, this is so great, need, not nearness. If we begin to understand neighbor in this way, it would be a beautiful day in our global neighborhood. That need actually demands function. The need actually demands action, and that part of the way, which is again what you're doing with, like, let's not just sit on dictionaries and definitions, but how do we live this? In order for a word to have meaning, specifically a word like neighbor, it has to be a lived word. You have to live the word neighbor in order for that to have meaning.
What you're seeing here is this connection between our lives and our words. In other words, the way that most of us live, we live as if we have no obligation to the person around the world. Why? Mm-hmm. Well, it's actually a rhetorical problem, because the way that we have come to understand neighbor rhetorically has implications for the way that we live ethically. So most people, we think about faith in terms of like behavioral modification. We think, hey, you know what? We've got a refugee crisis around the world. Let's start a new ministry. Let's try to whip people up. Let's go into churches with our slideshows. Right. We think, let's start with the ethics. But, you know, C.S. Lewis said something that was fascinating, and it's true. He said, you don't get first things by putting second things first. You get first things by putting first things first. Mm. Words matter. There are implications in our language for our lives. And so when we don't understand the concept of neighbor, neighborhood, neighborliness, it has implications in our lives. And just starting with the second thing, which is the way we live, which is very important, and putting that first, what we find is we end up fighting an uphill battle because people go, yeah, that person's not my neighbor, and I already at the office. And so they don't want to engage in what we fail to realize is that so many of our ethical problems with Christians in the United States is actually at its root a rhetorical issue.
That's fantastic. The word brokenness, in my reading of the book, if there's an emotional kind of peak to the book, it's the chapter on brokenness and the word brokenness. And if you don't mind, I'm going to read a section from the book and then ask you to pick it up from there and vamp a little bit. You write, in a world where sin has become a dirty word, brokenness has become all the rage among Christians. We use it to describe circumstances we don't like, and often to label people people who don't fit our notions of, quote, the good Christian life. I've heard Christians use the word broken to refer to divorced people, disabled people, depressed people, suicidal people, gay and lesbian people, transgender people. In these cases, the word has become a cudgel to malign and marginalize, quote, other individuals who are no more or no less in need of God's grace than the labelers themselves. The B word has become a stepladder to describe people we don't understand or like or want to make space for. Can you pick the ball up from there and dig in a little bit personally and culturally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, the late Richard Weaver famously said, ideas have consequences. And so using rooting yourself in the idea of brokenness, you have to ask, what are the consequences? What is the reaction to that action? What is the thing that flows from that we experience as a result of that? I talk in this book about how I use that word to refer to my own sexual orientation. I had a very public situation where my sexual orientation, thanks, and I use the word thanks loosely, to an individual who
I remember the sequence.
Shared some very personal information about a relationship we had years ago online. And I had referred to myself, to my orientation, as broken. And if you go into, and I mentioned it in that quote, if you go into a lot of churches, a lot of religious communities today, you're going to find that's not uncommon. We go, oh gosh, oh, she's divorced. She's just really broken. She's in a broken this and a broken that. And we talk about people in this way as if they need to be fixed. And maybe the situation that they're facing is no fault of their own. And maybe it can't actually be fixed. A great example of this is sexual orientation. I mean, we know now science has pretty well settled this question that sexual orientation is not something you can just flip on and off like a light switch. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a lot of people out there, particularly straight Western conservative Christians, who they still believe that if a person is, quote, gay, well, then you just can do something to manipulate the system, and you flip the light switch and now you're straight. The funny thing is if I ask that same person, well, what could I do to flip your switch and make you gay? They would say nothing.
Right.
Which is always so weird and fascinating. Like, okay, so the switch only works when it's somebody who you don't like or you don't know or you don't understand.
Somebody who's broken.
Yeah, somebody who is, quote, broken.
Right.
So what I say is that word broken assumes something, particularly that whatever is, quote, broken can be fixed. And that just doesn't apply to many of these situations in which we've used it. And so as a result, it becomes harmful because it actually goes from an adjective to a noun, not this thing outside of me I describe as broken, but it is me. It is the essence of me. I am broken. And so there's no wonder why the various groups that we've used this term with impunity to describe them often saturate our churches with their absence.
It's like the difference between, or functional difference between, guilt and shame, where guilt has to do with, I did a thing, I feel bad about it. And shame is, this is who I am, and there's nothing I can do about it except feel bad about who I am.
Yeah, there's a difference in I messed up and I'm messed up.
Yeah.
But I would take that a step further to say, even if you're trying not to describe the person, but the orientation is broken. Oftentimes when we use words, we're telling the truth, but we're not telling the whole truth, so help me God. Mm-hmm. So you're getting at something that might be true, but when you look at the consequences of telling that partial truth in that way, you realize it's really damaging. It's not kind, it's not loving, it's not helpful, and it's not actually all that accurate. And so what I say in the book is that there are examples of brokenness in the world, but that we have to stop using brokenness in ways that do not make sense and ways that cause harm to others.
To describe, instead of diminish.
Well, yeah, and if you read the Bible, and I'm sure a lot of you people do who listen to this, that when the word brokenness is used, and it's not used often, So this concept of brokenness is a modern linguistic insertion into the language of faith, which is that's not a bad thing to insert new language into the vocabulary of faith, but it is modern. But when you read it in the scriptures, you know, the psalmist says, talks about a broken heart, a crushed spirit. He's talking about something that happens to us, not something that we are, right? A transgender person is not broken. That's who they are. That's not something that happened to them. They didn't get bit by a tick and now they're transgender. They have this sort of complex biological, physiological, psychological situation.
Right.
And that's part of who they are. And they have to sort through that. But to call them broken is not a biblical way even of thinking of that word. And in the scripture, when the word broken is used, it's not used to describe somebody as less than. It is used to describe someone who is especially close to God, that God is close to the brokenhearted, the psalmist says. We use it as a negative term, as a way to kind of sort somebody into a box and say, oh, well, you know what? That person, they're saying a whole bunch of things that are just messed up because they're just broken. And we use it as almost a term of condescension, where in the scripture, at least in the few times it's used to lift up, to elevate. And so I think that the way we've used that term has really gotten away from us and really has harmed a lot of people. And I would say including us. Including those of us who have spoken it to both the speaker and to the person we've labeled with that term.
Kirsten Powers endorses your book on the back. She's a hero of mine. I think she's fantastic. I pay attention to what she does on television and online. And she would be identified as a journalist. I don't know if you necessarily identify yourself as a journalist. I read a lot of what you do in that direction, like I haven't seen you described necessarily. I mean, you call yourself a faith and culture writer, so I don't know if you would necessarily consider yourself a journalist, but a lot of what you do has even this book has this very journalistic bent.
But I mean, journalism is always divided kind of into two broad categories: reporting and opinion.
And I
do opinion work. Kirsten does mostly opinion work, but she does a fair amount of reporting in her columns too. She's really good at kind of crossing over, and even she has a little bit more of an unbiased impulse, where she's just trying to tell the truth, whereas I come with a point of view. But we both kind of sit loosely in that category of journalism.
Right. So, and that's kind of what I wanted to get at. And I'm not exactly sure how to get into this from like a straightforward question, but that's exactly the space I want to move into and talk about the truth telling. Because a moment ago, you used the phrase to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And when it comes to public truth telling, maybe, you know, I'm blinded by my own cultural moment as well. So like, I would say something now, like now more than ever, which is the thing that gets it, but now more than any time I can remember, like the role of a public truth teller, the difficulty of being a public truth teller, like yourself or like Kirsten, it seems nearly impossible to be perceived as, to be perceived or received as a public truth teller, that there's this, particularly in the world of journalism, everyone has an angle. Everyone is slanted and biased, etc. Do you find it like? Do you feel like it's possible to tell the truth? Maybe this is the question. Like, what does it mean now to tell the truth publicly? What's it mean to be like? Insofar as you're writing about culture, you're writing about faith. And in both cases, particularly in the matter of faith, like it matters to readers. The idea of truth matters to readers. And people who watch the news, people watching CNN, or otherwise, the truth matters. Like, what does it mean now to tell the truth about faith, about politics? What's it mean for you to tell the truth?
Yeah, it's super fraught. It's super difficult. I'm one of those people. I tend to draw a bit more from the European school of journalism than the American school of journalism. So the American school of journalism really, really loves this notion of being unbiased. I think that that is an impossibility, that you cannot eliminate bias. Who we are, our own context, that is a part of us. And the best we can do is minimize it. And there are some reporters out there who do a great job of minimizing it. But they're always coming with a set of facts, and they are piecing those facts together into a narrative. And the how you piece together facts, there are an infinite number of ways. But they're making decisions on how to piece together the facts into a way of understanding a story that is always touched by, to some degree, their bias. So I don't believe we can be unbiased, if that answers that question. So when people are like, look at you, you're just being biased, I'm like, so what? First of all, I'm an opinion writer, so I'm paid to have a bias. But beyond any of that, that's just called being a human. Like, we all have a cultural context. We all have experiences that have shaped us in certain ways, and that's just the way that it is. So that doesn't bother me. Beyond that, I think you're asking this question about what it means to be a truth teller. And so what I'll say is this, and I, you know, this could be a podcast in and of itself.
I bet.
But I always think, as a Christian, being a truth teller means speaking two kinds of truth. There is the is and the ought.
That's good.
And both of those things are things we have to tell the truth about. Reporters often will focus more on the is, and opinion columnists help us sometimes with the ought, but it means to say what is. You're lying. That is not true. You, President of the United States, are saying X, but we all know Y is true. Mm-hmm. That is a lie. That is not true. To call attention to epidemics in this country, racism and sexism, and to have difficult conversations about what is. That is hard. It is difficult. There have been various truth tellers in various roles in American history that have played that part. Pastors play that part. Journalists play that part. Historians play that part. So you have various people who play important roles in our society, and it's why we need pastors and journalists to be free to keep telling the truth of what is. But then I think that notion of what ought to be, to say, here's what is, but here is what ought to be. And here's how we get to where what ought to be, and to make compelling cases for what ought to be, is super, super difficult, but it's very, very important.
You and this, I'll wrap it up. Is so much of what you do with the book, and that's part of why I wanted to move in the direction of truth telling, and you touched on it really well. The idea of, like, you just to have an angle, to have a bias, is human, and insofar as that's inescapable, the thing that you're left with is to be that, and to be that faithfully, to not try to become or whatever it is, to become, like, you know, unbiased and pure in your opinions and feelings, what have you. And this thing you write towards the tail, the chapter called "In the Beginning" was the conversation. And you sort of point people towards, like, be engaged with one another because you're human. The passage you write about the person of Jesus, that Jesus is also a reminder that words are not enough. When God wanted to explain what God is like, the explanation took the form of flesh, not just speech. The incarnation reminds us that we are both liberated and limited by our words. That part of what you're getting into with the book, and what I think you do well and faithfully online and otherwise, is you're not leaning super hard into, like, trying to pin down definitions. You're honestly trying to set up engagement and conversation. So the folks will feel like it's not the words you need to engage with. It's the people. It's the person using the word. That if you want to understand the definition of the word or how the word is being used, you have to understand the person who's using the word and the culture that person comes from. So if you am I kind of closing us out with like a little bit of it, sort of moving in that direction, that the idea of, like, in the beginning was the conversation. Like, land the plane there. In the beginning was the conversation. How do we take that and carry that out?
Well, I think what that says is a conversation as opposed to a word. And by the way, that's not just my reinterpretation of John chapter 1. It actually is Erasmus, who was one of the early translators of the Greek Bible. His reinterpretation to be more faithful to the word that actually is used there in the Greek. But conversation is dynamic. It is ongoing. It involves a speaker and a listener. In fact, the listener speaks back. And I think this is the idea of what God is and what God is calling us into, that God is not just speaking to us from above, but is calling us to participate with God in something. Now, there are lots of ways to connect with God. Three primary that I think of is silence, speaking, and embodiment, acting. Right? You can do all of these things. I talked about silence in a chapter in a previous book. This whole book is about the sacred act of speaking. But as I hint at the end of this book, there's also the embodiment of it, that at the end of the day, being called into this divine conversation is not just that we would speak grace, but that we would become grace. Not just that we would speak about mercy and compassion and love, but that we would embody mercy and compassion and love. We would become mercy to others. We would become love to other people. And so just using words, if people read this book and they walk out of, they close the book and all they do is just start running their mouths, then I've failed. They have, that the words we use must be accompanied by visible expressions of those words' transformative power. And if they're not, then our words become, in the full definition of the word, incredible. They become unbelievable. And so what I want to say there is that this book is not setting up a linguistic totem. It's not creating the idolatry of language to say the only thing that's required of you if you want to follow after God is just to speak about God, is just to talk about God. It is only one step toward the divine, toward communion with the divine, toward loving our neighbors. But there are actually other steps that are necessary and that must accompany this particular step. So go speak God from scratch, but then also embody all of these words as you encounter them, as you reimagine them, as you breathe new life into many of these words that are almost dead or are now dying.
Fantastic. Jonathan, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it, man.
My pleasure, friend. Thank you so much.
And thank you for joining us for this episode of the At Sea Podcast. If you'd like to follow up with Jonathan Merritt, you can go to jonathanmerritt.com, two R's, two T's, and the name Merritt. From there, you can reference all of his online written work, as well as jump to any place you normally buy our books to find his newest book, Learning to Speak God from Scratch. Meanwhile, if you like what we're up to with the At Sea Podcast, and you like the way we're breathing life into older words and helping some of the newer words find a little bit more of a place in our cultural context, we'd love to have you on the team. Jump over to patreon.com and search my name, Justin McRoberts. Until next time.